BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Well, I last saw our next guest in Las Vegas, but it wasn't the kind of Vegas trip that I like. It was media day for Oregon State, Washington State. I was there for a blink. I didn't do any gambling. There was no pool involved. Jake Dickert joining us. How was that trip for you?
Well, it's always good to be on, John. I'll tell you this. You didn't do any of those things. I think I got a couple of those things on your list in. So it was positive for us. It's our kind of first time, in our current situation and really turning the page and moving forward and setting the sights in a different direction. Yet let everyone know we're still here. We're relevant. We're a big-time football program, and we want to move forward, and we're focused on this season and what we need to do to be successful. So it was great for our guys to be a part of. The Pac-12 did a really good job of putting on an excellent event, and now we're excited about where we're headed.
Yeah, you guys did a really good job telling your story, and I thought it was really well produced. I also think, this season is going to be really important for you. Let's back up, though. Let's go way back, because I was thinking about this. I was talking to another media member about kind of what you have been through as a head coach. You took over the program. It was a kind of amid some turmoil. Now, then you encounter the conference the way it is. Has all of that equipped you or prepared you in a way for what you're going through right now? Like you've been through some stuff already in Pullman.
There's a long story to that journey that I'm going to write someday, but it's one of those things, John, where you're now seasoned, and I've been seasoned quickly through the fire instead of, over the course of 10 years, you'd see all that stuff. I've seen it in my first two, and I look at it as a blessing. I'm a better football coach today because of that. And I've made plenty of mistakes, and I'm willing to admit that and learn from that and grow from that and keep this program moving forward. So, like I said, in our program, John, there's no losses. There's just wins and learns. And every adversity, everything that's thrown our way, you got to stay agile. I continue to remind our guys, this is life. Football is life. Things are constantly changing and adjusting, and you got to keep moving. The best part about it is you got to have the right people with you. Okay, not the best people, the right people. Because the right people, when the course changes, is ready to attack it head on. Right? And they just didn't get on the bus because of where we were going 2 years ago. They're on it for where we're going and what we're going to do in the future. So it's been an interesting journey, to say the least. But I've learned a lot through it. I've grown a lot through it. And I just like to say I'm a better coach, person, husband, man, because of all the adversity we've been through.
We had a youth soccer game in our household over the weekend, and our youngest daughter was playing, and really competitive game, and she played really hard, and I was really proud of her. And in the end, they ended up losing a close game. And I thought to myself as I was leaving, Coach, I thought, in some ways, this is better. Like, youth sports is a great place for kids to fail. It's a safe place for kids to fail, I should say. And I think that we get more out of those setbacks sometimes than the wins. Are you believing that?
I'm in the same mode you are there with, my son in baseball tournament, and they went to, the 10U state tournament and lost, and you get those tears. And, my yes. wife's like, you want to console him, and I'm just kind of, this is great. It's what a learn, because he messed up, and, you just to go through that process, I'm smiling, and, he's crying a little bit, but it's one of those things where you're just like, this is so great, and I'm with you, John. It teaches us. It grows. We learn, so you're prepared for the next moment when you're in that deal. You're ready for it, because what I've learned last year, most importantly, you get tons of learns, too, from success. How you handle adversity and success is really the same in my point from a coaching standpoint. You got to be able to handle both because there's things that come from that part of it, too. And not enough people kind of talk about that. They talk about the hard things, but how you handle success is also a great indicator for what your program can do and more importantly, the character of the individuals within your organization.
I feel better now because the 8-year-old, after the game, she walked over to me and she buried her face in my shirt and started crying. And I was smiling, and my wife is going, "Why are you smiling that she's crying?" I'm like, "Oh, no, this is great. Like, she's going to learn that she will survive this. She's going to learn resilience. This is going to be awesome in about a half an hour when she realizes, she just needs to get back to work." So I love,
just wait,
love
just,
that.
Just wait till you get the first, like, breakup. You know, my daughter just kind of yes. had, like, the first. She doesn't, she's not allowed to date, by the way. But
right.
you're kind of hanging out with somebody, and then the first breakup. Those are the tears, and same thing. I'm smiling all the way.
I got to think that the kids at her school are going, like, you know, Mr. Dickert, I don't want to have to see Mr. Dickert, you know. And you kind of have to have that presence.
I told John I got one rule. I said, you better come over and say hi
right.
quickly, right? You
right.
better introduce himself and have a great handshake.
Yep, there it is. Jake Dickert with us, Washington State coach. I remember leaving the spring game, and I was really impressed with Wayshon Parker, one of your running backs, freshman, just really electric player with the ball. How's your backfield in general look?
I think light years ahead of where we were the last 2 years. And there's not a knock on anybody besides we've invested a lot to get depth in that room. Wayshon is one of those pieces for sure. He's shown that, you know, through the course of our first seven in fall camp, that a true freshman and a mid-year enrollee has an opportunity at that position with, you know, limited mental things you need to know that can go out there and let his skills show. He's continued to do that. Excited to see this first scrimmage. You know, Leo Pulalasi in the Cal game last year before he got injured was electric, another freshman. You know, so we're really poised, you know, to take a step forward in that room. Javinsky Slimbaker, Dylan Payne. So I'm excited about what those guys are doing. And you know it, John, because that's the next step of the question. We have to be able to run the football. And I think it isn't just that group. It's the offensive line that we have a lot more depth and feel very comfortable about having more explosiveness out of our offensive run game.
Some of your coaches are talking about that after the first few practices. I saw some quotes in some of the papers, you know, that they felt like you're up front, you were more physical. Are you seeing that? Is there a physicality there in general, or is it a mentality, or you just have bigger guys? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I think it's everything in between. You know, I think we were handed a dicey situation in 22 at the offensive line, and we've really invested in it. And it's, you know, through strength and conditioning, it's definitely through size because we were getting smaller in the old scheme. You know, but it's also now we got five guys that have started football games in the Pac-12 returning. And that's a luxury to have as well as competitive depth underneath it. You know, 2 years ago, you know, we got a couple offensive linemen hurt early in fall camp, and it was just ugly. And now we're finally getting to that point where we're sustaining. Those guys are out there. They can handle the physicality of what we're putting them through. And I think it's just a testament to consistency throughout our program. I mean, we have head coach, offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, special teams coordinator, strength and conditioning coordinator, all back. I don't have the numbers of how many people in the country have that, but I think that's what it leads to. And I think that consistency is really good, especially for the offensive line.
Yeah, and you've had other seasons, off seasons, where you were hiring and focused more on that mm-hmm. stuff. But, you know, let's talk about youth in general. I've heard coaches say that you can be young at certain positions and not others. Let's start on the defense, because you're a defensive guy. If you're mm-hmm. going to be young, you know, where can you afford to be young? Maybe young and talented is good, but and where can you not afford to be young on defense?
Yeah, I mean, I would say first and foremost, the interior three guys. You know, you can play, we've done it, played with some young guys in interior defensive line, some pass rush specialists. Corners, if you're really talented, is not a taxing mental position. But the core of our defense, the nickel cover guys, strong safety, Mike and Will, very rarely have I ever been able to play a freshman at that position. And it's just because in today's football, the adjustments, the tempo, the things that you need to know and communicate, it is a complicated game played at warp speed. And high school doesn't get you prepared for that. So in order to do that at that position, you have to be a mid-year enrollee. You have to be able to knock out those 15 spring practices. But at the same time, we do a lot of things, John, that maybe other programs don't do is, you know, we do young guy walkthroughs every morning to prepare those guys and get them more mental reps. After practice, we'll send the old guys, you know, to the ice tubs. We'll get 20 more reps with those young guys because I'm about the learning and developing. And when you get to, you know, game 11, 12, you want to get 13, 14, 15, you're going to be relying on some of those guys that you think might just end up on the scout team. So the developmental process that these kids need to go through are huge. Once we sign them, we start meeting with them on Zoom. Like, we get this thing rolling because we're in a competitive setting, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. You don't know how long you're going to have these kids anymore. So we want to get them fast learning to see what they have and what they can contribute to the team right now.
Yeah, give me an idea how you deal with that, because you signed a whole bunch of high school kids that are going to be young in your program. I like the approach. I guess the thinking is you're going to have them, and you're going to grow them, and you're going to try to convince them that this is where they need to be. But, you know, how do you invest, knowing you're going to lose a portion of those guys? Everybody's going to lose those guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think right now we've created Major League Baseball, right? You know, but you got the Yankees, you know, and you got Moneyball, and we got to play Moneyball. You know, we got to find through the portal the guys that maybe some people didn't love because they're not just, you know, an all-around player, but they have specific traits that we feel fit our system. You know, as a high school recruit, you know, who's the guy that we can add 40 pounds to and develop? And we just know and prepare, like, you know, we get them to a certain All-American level, you know, we're going to have some conversations. And I've been really good about having those and being honest and upright with our guys. So it's a plan. It's a matrix. It's hard to figure it all out. I mean, the potential of the new 105 and influxing 800 scholarships at the top level is insane. You know, the shuffle that could potentially happen from that. But you got to take it one day at a time. You got to keep a big recruiting board. And more importantly, you got to show these players how you are providing value for them through development. And if you don't do that, if you don't have honest conversations, you're allowing their environment to control how they perceive where they're at versus having really tough, hard conversations about the truth. And then their job is to not manipulate the truth. Their job is to take it for input, and that's what allows them to grow and get better.
You've got Zev Eckhaus, you've got John Mateer. How are those guys different when you go out and you're sort of going through a practice with the skill sets?
Yeah, some people say, well, it's hard when they're not the same. I actually enjoy that they're very different. You know, Zevy, you know, has 3 years of starting experience, which I don't care at what level it is, you can't replicate that. And that's exciting to us. He's very calm and cool and collected in the pocket. He's seen everything. And I think he's one of the best kind of touch throwers I've been around. John Mateer, not that he's completely the opposite, but, you know, he's got a big, strong arm, and his athleticism, you know, is really off the charts. You know, so you can run John around a little bit. He can create some things, you know, that aren't there off script. And, you know, he's working on making great decisions when the play breaks down. So very uniquely different. I think they both have tremendous strengths. Whoever we end up going with, the one thing I tell Coach Buck, our offensive coordinator, is let's lean into what they do really well. You know, let's manage the deficiencies and let's lean into their strengths. So that can be a challenge as a play caller to have two different guys, but I think we can have success through two different styles of quarterback play.
Can you play two guys, or are you a believer if you've got two, you don't have one?
No. We're not going to play two guys. We're going to go with one. We're going to make a choice. I think that's important for the team. I think it's important for consistency, you know, O-line, quarterback, wide receiver, rhythm, you know, and, you know, we get paid to make big boy decisions, and that will be one of them. So, but at the end of the day, just like any other position, the guy that we go with does have to perform. That isn't a quick hook, but it is an understanding that we got to make sure we're advancing the team. And, you know, there's pressure that comes with that. We own that. These guys are excited about accepting that. But we will go with one guy when this is, you know, all said and done.
Yeah, I noticed at some of the other media days, I was talking to coaches, and they don't want to single out an individual player when they're giving praise. And I have a little bit of a problem with that because I feel like you should just be authentic and honest. But I get it. They're afraid they're going to lose somebody in the portal or that somebody psychologically will check out. Do you have to be careful in this era talking about guys in the spring, talking about guys in the summer to make sure that you're patting everybody on the back, or has it changed the way you talk about your team?
Well, they may be a touch, you know, but I think if I'm worried about everything that I do, John, that these guys are going to leave, what kind of environment am I providing them to thrive in,
right?
And I think you're just operating from a standpoint of fear and anxiety versus let's go out and do it the right way. And I think that's what we choose to do here. We know it's not perfect and everyone's going to stay. I know that. But at the end of the day, just what's best for them is best for us. And we move on a stance that we're doing great things here and they want to be a part of this program. So I just otherwise, man, I wouldn't be able to sleep every night thinking what's going to happen, who's going where. It's tough. You know, I've just come to the understanding now that your kids are in the portal every day. They can only leave two times a year, right? But they're in the portal every day, right? And you know, it's just kind of the way that we've created this, unfortunately, or not fortunately. I mean, it just is what it is. So, once again, honest conversation and truth helps. And, you know, trying to get on the same page earlier in the night is something that, you know, that we do here at Washington State.
I like your schedule. I liked it the minute I saw it. I went, look, you got Texas Tech at home. That's a big opportunity to show you belong. There, you have several of those opportunities. You have the Washington game in week three. I think that's going to be a dogfight, always is. You go to Boise State. You go to Fresno State. I covered what was the WAC back in the day when, you know, I was in Fresno working at the Fresno Bee. That is a tough place to play. So is Boise. I think my takeaway is you're going to have some opportunities to show that CFP committee that Washington State might be the best team out there that's not in a Power Four.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Every opportunity that you just spoke on is afforded to us through this schedule. There's no doubt about it. And we're just going to be focused on what we need to do game to game. What you said is absolutely the truth. I mean, I've been in Fresno. It's a tougher place to play than Stanford. You know, talking about the environment.
Yes.
You know, I've been to Boise. It's a tougher place to play than Arizona State as far as the environment. You know, I've spent 3 years in that league. So the biggest thing we're focused on is that standards are internal, expectations are external. And fighting, you know, the outside noise of, hey, that's just the Mountain West, don't worry about it. It doesn't work like that. You know, we're going to walk into hostile environments with a target on our back ready to come beat us, and we got to match that intensity and live up to our standard of play. So we're excited about doing that, but absolutely, this provides us every opportunity we need to go out there and get into one of those seven college football playoff spots.
Jake Dickert with us. All right, before I cut you loose, the end of summer before football, did you, as a family, did you take a trip, do a vacation, or was it all youth sports all summer?
No, we got to in the middle, you know, go to Lake Coeur d'Alene. You know, we kind of Airbnb'd a place. I rented a boat, which I didn't even know that they can just give you the keys to a boat, and yes, they just tell you to drive it, and you've never driven one before. We paddleboarded, we kayaked, we got the kids up on old school skis. That was like heaven. You know, my wife whipped me off the tube a couple times, if I'm being honest. So we got away, we enjoyed, we had tons of family time, and I've learned a lot about that too, John. I got to be able to recharge so I can reinvest, you know, my energy in what I'm doing, and that was the best way to do it, is kind of just staying close to home base and enjoying every moment I could.
I'm looking at your opener with Portland State. I might go to that game because I'm looking at all the games. I think that might be the most interesting or compelling game because I want to see you guys early, and Bruce Barnum will bring a team in there that I know will scrap. And so, you know, there's some games out there that I'm not that interested in, but I think for your fan base, I guess my last question would be, like, what message do you have to your fans this season in general as far as tuning into the CW to see Washington State play and showing up to see Washington State play?
I think it's a real simple message. Be there. Invest. Show who we are. We're going to get this 1 year of being in the spotlight, and Washington State's got to shine in every moment. And, you know, Cougs watch all over this country. There's more access than ever through our partnership with the CW. But Geisa Field needs to be rocking for every home game that we possibly have, because that's what these kids deserve. They stayed here for a reason. We need to reward them with one of the best environments in the country.
Thank you, Jake Dickert. Appreciate you.
Always. Go Cougs!
And there he goes, Jake Dickert, Washington State football coach. Big season ahead for the Beavers, for the Cougars. And it's really going to challenge fans psychologically because, on one hand, the fans at Washington State and Oregon State are obviously disappointed with what has transpired over the last year, 18 months, with the Pac-12 conference. On the other hand, if they want to be with the Haves one day, this season's a stepping stone and an opportunity to prove you belong. And there is a CFP berth out there for somebody. Why not Oregon State? Why not Washington State? They will be fighting with the best schools in the Mountain West Conference. They'll be fighting with the best schools in the American Athletic Conference. And, you know, Washington State's got a ton of returners. The schedule provides opportunities. Oregon State, the same way. I'm a little more worried about Oregon State because Trent Bray, as a first-time, first-year head coach, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and it costs you here or there. But big opportunities this season for these two teams. Leave it here. You got the BFT. Punch It Audio is next.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
I'm excited that we're getting closer and closer to college football games. Starting to map out part of the season as the coverage plans at johnconzano.com are unfolding. I'm going to be all over all of these Pac-12 teams that are scattering off into the ACC and the Big 12 and the Big 10. Certainly cover Oregon, Oregon State, Oregon, Washington State. I'm going to dabble a little in the Mountain West Conference. If you're interested in college football, if you're interested in good stories, if you're interested in where the action is, go to johnconzano.com if you want to read my written work. I wrote today about the Oregon Lottery and the DraftKings sports wagering app. Steven, I'm sure that you were into this one, but I found out that business is good when it comes to DraftKings. Fiscal year ended June 30th, so I got my hands on the Oregon Lottery's numbers for the last year. Set a record. More money was wagered. More money was put into the pockets of the Oregon Lottery, which, if it gets to where it's supposed to get, is a good thing. Public schools, veterans organizations, parks, the natural habitat. I know schools are hurting, but the money from the Oregon Lottery, $26.8 million in profits were put into the state's pockets. That's up from $17 million a year ago. So great growth. It went from $6 million to $12 million to $17 million, now $26.8 million. But I wrote about the fact that you can't wager on a college sporting event with using the DraftKings app. And I really started to drill down on what people are wagering on. I found out a couple of interesting things before I get to punch at audio here. But a couple of interesting things. The biggest month in history as it pertains to sports wagering in the state of Oregon was May of 2024, earlier this year, just a few months ago. In May, $76 million was wagered by Oregonians using the DraftKings platform. That was up from $41 million last May. So tremendous growth from May of 2023 to May of 2024. $41 million to $76 million. The boost was driven by the NBA playoffs. $27 million was wagered on the NBA playoffs in May of 2024. Now, in the end of the regular season as well. Baseball wagering accounted for $19 million, which was a huge spike up from where baseball had been just a year earlier. I expected it would be December to be the biggest month. And in fact, December was the old record. December of 2023 generated $74 million in bets. And that's where basketball and football overlap, the NBA and NFL overlaps. And so I think next December, it could be a $100 million month. It could. Just the growth suggests it's headed in that direction. But NFL games in December of 2023 did $28.5 million in wagers. And the state of Oregon generated $4 million in profit on the $28 million in wagers. The NBA did $26 million in December of 2023. Good for a profit of $3.4 million. So a couple things jumping out at me. Sports wagering does not pay for the vast majority of people. The house is winning. Secondarily, the football-basketball overlap is underperforming. It should be a lot higher. And why isn't it higher? Well, it's because you can't wager on a college sporting event. You cannot wager on the CFP. You cannot wager on March Madness. You can't wager on the college basketball season. You can't wager on the regular season of college teams. You know, there's just some issues there with, you know, the inability for people to place wagers on college sporting events. And we all know what it is driven by. You can say all you want that this is about, you know, anti-gambling and, you know, people trying to take precautions, or you can say, hey, it's about the sanctity of college athletics. It's not it. It's not it. It has to do with the tribal casinos and a monopoly that they enjoy on sports wagering when it comes to college events. They have lined the pockets of lobbyists, who have lined the pockets of politicians, who to this point have blocked bills, including HB 1503 in 2022. Peter Courtney, the great former late great senator in this state, introduced HB 1503 in his final legislative session in 2022. He proposed that college sports wagering should be allowed and that the proceeds should go to scholarships for people who could not afford to go to college. I think it was a great idea. Solved a couple of problems, but the lobbyists working on behalf of the tribal casinos called for a task force and a commission study, and Peter Courtney said that is political code for kill the bill. Kill the bill. And in the end, the bill got killed. And so now we're in a position, are we not, where we're watching Oregon State testify in front of state lawmakers and say, hey, we need help. We need a subsidy. And they asked for $10 million, and they got it. $10 million for athletic scholarships coming from the general fund. I proposed today in print at johnconzano.com, and it's not a perfect idea because, you know, I do have some hesitation about advocating for gambling and gambling and more gambling and more gambling, and this is a good thing. And again, like, you know, but as long as people are gambling, some good should come from it. And for people who have gone offshore to place their college sports wagers, being able to place them inside the state of Oregon not only ensures that you are protected as a consumer, but it potentially results in millions of dollars in revenue for the state of Oregon. And so my proposal in print today is let's reintroduce this bill, HB 1503, except let's tweak it a little bit. College sports wagering should be allowed in the state of Oregon, and the proceeds should not only go to fund scholarships for students who might not otherwise be able to afford college, but how about it goes to fund NIL collectives at Oregon State, Portland State, community colleges, small colleges, and the University of Oregon? If we're being fair, University of Oregon is going to get a 50% distribution from the Big Ten. It's going to put them at a $180 million disadvantage versus everybody else in the Big Ten. I'm not saying Oregon's pleading poverty here. Oregon might not even need the money, but I feel like Oregon State, Portland State in particular, and the small colleges in the state, NAIA schools, community colleges, have a lot of athletes who could benefit from a fund that would include tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, once this thing is up and running and humming, that could help solve some problems and keep these entities from approaching lawmakers in legislative sessions and saying, hey, we need a subsidy. Oregon State needed $10 million. Wouldn't it be great if that wagering and on college sporting events in the state of Oregon actually helped college athletes in the state of Oregon? Just think it out loud here. If you're a lawmaker and you're listening to this show, and damn it, Peter Courtney used to listen every day. And I love that he listened in the state capitol every day because we gave him a couple of good ideas over the years. We gave him some bad ideas, but this is not one of my bad ideas. This is a good idea. Why not create legislation that solves a problem, keeps people from going to the black market of sports gaming, and creates revenue that will prohibit or solve the issue of schools going to the state legislature with their handout saying, hey, we need $10 million in the next session? Yes, I get it. Gambling scares some people. And, you know, I walk into some establishments that have those poker machines and I always look over and I'm like, it's not a pretty picture sometimes when you see who's sitting at those machines. You know what I'm talking about. It's somebody who is addicted and has got issues. But I'm not talking about video poker here. I'm talking about sports gaming. I'm talking about responsible gaming. I'm talking about, hey, if they're going to be gaming anyway, shouldn't there be a positive byproduct? March Madness, no ability for you to place a wager legally with the DraftKings app in Oregon. The college football playoff in the regular season, no ability. Can you imagine the financials? I posted some of them online. $26.8 million in profit for the state of Oregon this year as it pertains to sports gaming. That is more than four times what it was 3 years ago. It's going to continue to grow. It's been steady growth in the last 4 years. And Stephen Vaughn, you tell me, for those who will argue, hey, you're just giving the degenerate gambler another place to go be a degenerate gambler, I kind of think those gamblers are already going offshore.
Yeah, I think you're right. I may or may not have had to do that before and have done that in the past and may do that in the future because it is so much easier just to do it from your phone or from your computer to be able to make a bet on a college football game or a college basketball game. And that's what, you know, I think the state of Oregon would make so much more money if they allowed you to bet on college sports. Like, I know people that gamble on the NFL that say, well, I just, you know, if they had college, I would bet on it on DraftKings, but they don't, so I'm just not going to, you know, do it. So it's just not a big deal. But if they had it, yeah, sure, I'd throw my money down on it just because why not? It's there. And so I think, like, for a lot of people, it is just entertainment, and so they will find ways to bet on those games, and it's just safer that way. It's safer to have it regulated in the state of Oregon rather than having to go offshore where you never know exactly what you're going to get.
And I, you know, I did reach out to a couple lawmakers and I just said, hey, read this. Tell me why this doesn't work. Because my idea is, you know, if you're going to have the ability for people to use this DraftKings app and it's going to now start to pace $75 million, $100 million, $125 million in monthly handle, the total amount of money wagered, the turnover, as they call it, in the state of Oregon in the hallways. If you're going to have a turnover that's going to approach $100 million a year, or excuse me, a month, and, you know, $100 to $120 million a year in gross gaming revenue or gross profit, I would kind of like to see some of that money go back to the schools and go to the colleges and help athletes and... Is it the worst idea to put some money in Oregon State's pocket and Portland State's pocket and the community colleges and the small colleges, D2, NAIA, and if Oregon can make a case saying, hey, we're at a disadvantage in the Big Ten, could you throw us a bone while you're doing it to everyone else? I'm not closing the door on that either. I just think it solves a problem. I also noted something else. I looked at activity by sports, Stephen. You're going to geek out on this. So I looked at baseball, basketball, football, hockey, soccer, and tennis. I looked at every month since the inception of the Oregon Lottery's, gaming app and then DraftKings 2021 on every single month. Do you know what sport gamblers had the most success in?
I would guess baseball.
It is baseball. Single game wagering in baseball. The state made, by percentage, the least amount of money, least successful. They had the kind of the worst batting average came in baseball for the DraftKings app. It seems as though people who bet on baseball have a better idea of what they're doing. Or maybe they're just betting pitching matchups. I don't know. And the worst came in sports like ice hockey and football and basketball. So, you know, it was just like sort of arbitrary to see what happened there. Single game bets, people did better than parlays, and you'd expect that. But the numbers are out there. I printed it at johnconzano.com today. If you're interested in it, whether you agree or disagree, I'd love to, you know, get your feedback in the comment section. Some people said, hey, you're just encouraging people to gamble. Others said, no, if they're going to gamble, you might as well, like some good might as well come from it. Like Portland State, I could see being a huge beneficiary here because it would give Portland State an angle in the big sky. If the DraftKings app was providing Portland State with a sliver of the action on college sports wagering, a couple million bucks a year, talk about a game changer for a university that probably every time it does its budget is going, I hope we can afford to make this happen. Be a huge advantage to a school like Portland State, Linfield, and others. I mean, I'm willing to say, like, could you open it up to NIL collectives in general that would help the small colleges, even the private schools? I'm just spitballing here. I think it's a good place to have ideas. Punch and Audio is coming up. Leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We're going to play some Punch It Audio, 5 at 5, coming up top of the hour. Good guest today. Brandon Huffman was fantastic. Jake Dickert was great. Do you notice the theme? Jake Dickert rented a boat with his family, and there was a tube involved. Dan Lanning rented a boat with his family, although Dan Lanning rented a pontoon boat and pulled a tube behind it on a lake. But he had a bunch of cousins and kids he was pulling around. You notice the theme there? The people getting out, the coaches are boating. They're getting on lakes in the summertime.
Well, do you think it's because they like they feel like they're, you know, they're at peace on the water, but they're also in control? Like they're driving, like
yes.
Jake Dickert talk about, you know, just give me a boat and you give me the keys, I can drive. Like they want to be in charge of something and be in front and hold their own, their own fate, but they also want to be at peace, I think.
Yeah, I completely get that. And Dan Lanning said he's the driver. He's always the driver. Doesn't like to be pulled around, but Dickert did say he was on the back of a boat. My whole thing is, if I'm ever on the water with kids involved, I'm always kind of the safety guy. I turn into that person. You know, there's one in every group. I'm that guy. I want everyone to come home safely. It's like my mission. We're not leaving anybody behind out here. We're not, you know, everybody's got their life jacket on. I'm always interested in trying to be super careful on the water. And it stems back, I mean, honestly, I won't go too deep into this, but it just stems back to my own childhood. I had two friends who, when I was very young, didn't make it. And I will never forget that. It doesn't leave me. And so I am like just Mr. Hyper-vigilant. Not anxious, but just vigilant. I'm just, I talk to everybody about the safety rules, protocols. It's a hot day. You keep your life jacket on. Doesn't matter. That's the rule. I'm always interested in keeping people safe. But I think the coaches, they need to be driving the boat, because you're right, Stephen. I think they want total control of that vessel in the same way that they control their program, Jim Harbaugh. Let's play some Punch It Audio.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters. Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio, presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Well, the Hawks are out, and they're accusing Oregon of buying players. This comes from the Tennessee Footprint media member there, Volquest, Brent Hubbs, saying Oregon's buying players. Punch it.
We talk about NIL a lot, right? NIL, NIL, NIL. At some point, when the money's pretty even, it comes down to where you're most comfortable. So you got to go recruit them. I think Oregon is learning this, right? Oregon just kind of had the thought process of, we'll just go buy us a class. And they've lost three or four commits in the last 2 weeks because they don't really want to work in live in Eugene. And I don't think they've got the coaches have the relationships with those players that other schools have. I think they've just said, well, we'll NIL it. You can't just NIL it because everybody's got NIL funds now, okay? I mean, at the Power 5 level, everybody's got a plan for NIL. So at some point it comes back to old school recruiting and your relationships, and you've got to work at it.
I'm not sure it does come back to that. Brandon Huffman, 24/7 Sports National Recruiting Editor, says that the idea that Oregon is buying players, well, whoever's perpetuating that is probably in second place.
I think that's usually what teams that aren't getting recruits are saying. It's never, hey, we got outworked, we got out-recruited, we got out-coached in a game. It's they bought themselves their class. They did something nefarious, and that's why we finished second. And, I mean, you go back to when Chip Kelly landed Eric Armstead and DeAnthony Thomas before NIL even existed. And, you know, Oregon, it's not like Oregon just came out of the blue and started recruiting well in the last 2.5 years. They've been recruiting well for the last 15 to 20 plus years. I mean, you can go back to Haladi Nada to say it. So I think that's just, you know, kind of runner-up mentality, if you will.
It is runner-up mentality. I always say if people who are whining about the advantages that others have would spend more time working, they might not be as far behind. That said, I think it is frustrating for some programs that look over and see Oregon and others, not just Oregon, having success. There are some new faces at the top of the recruiting rankings. Oregon State tight end Jermaine Terry talking about the growth of the program since spring. Punch it.
I think it feels different. I mean, there's a lot of change that happened, but I think we're heading in the right direction now. Especially looking back at spring, just I feel like we've grown as a team overall. And I'm really just excited to, you know, get the season started and play with these guys.
Yeah, I think Oregon State, it's not so much growth from last season to this season because so many players are different. So I think Terry's right in that the measurement for Oregon State has to be growth from the spring to now. It has to be that increment because at least these guys were here, or a lot of them were here. The other thing is, it's who wasn't there in the spring, namely quarterback Ben Gulbranson, who was not part of the spring scrimmage. He looks like he's going to be the guy at quarterback for Oregon State this season. They need him to be better than Ben Gulbranson from two seasons ago. Bo Nix, third on the depth chart with the Denver Broncos, says, "I could not care less. Punch it."
But before it came out, there was hubbub on social media, all that. You listed at number three. Did you kind of notice that promotion or anything like that? And
couldn't care less.
Okay. So is that generally on the depth chart? You know, you don't care how you're listed at this point, I guess, obviously.
Couldn't care less.
Headline's going to be Bo Nix doesn't care. But you get the point. He's not hung up on the fact that he's third on the depth chart. I think Sean Payton is doing a smart thing by taking pressure off his young quarterback. Not going to be in a situation where he's going to have to worry about, you know, what am I in second position, first position. I think Bo Nix ends the year as the starter in Denver. I think Sean Payton will only put him in position to succeed. So whether that is in week one against Seattle, or week five, or week eight, I think that is to be determined. That's the only question. But I think Sean Payton will wait. I think he will slowly introduce Bo Nix to the NFL in the way that when I set up a fish tank for my 8-year-old daughter, I slowly release the goldfish into the water. You got to acclimate them to the water. You stick them, you keep them in the bag. You know what I'm talking about. You don't just dump them in the water. They die from shock. Same thing happens to young quarterbacks. Bruce Feldman talking about Jim Harbaugh's show cause penalty, NCAA slapping him with a 4-year show cause penalty. It's kind of toothless, but here's Feldman talking about it. Punch it.
This, the one that the NCAA Committee on Infractions handed down today, which is a 4-year show cause, which basically means if somebody tried to hire Jim Harbaugh, it would be much harder to do it. At least if somebody in the NCAA world tried to hire Jim Harbaugh. Jim Harbaugh is now the coach of the Chargers. He just won a national title. I don't think Jim Harbaugh has any interest in coaching anywhere in college football anytime soon, probably again. So
then why do it?
It's the NCAA. They're going to finish up with whatever they started, and they feel like they have to. They have no power in this one, really. To, you know, they can shame Jim Harbaugh, and that's the extent of it.
I heard somebody compare it to deleting your ex-girlfriend's phone number out of your phone after she's broken up with you. There's no real penalty to Jim Harbaugh, but at the NCAA, it's a token move. It is a symbolic move, and in that, you know, the NCAA is just doing everything it possibly can do to say this isn't okay. Jim Harbaugh, meanwhile, insisting he never did anything wrong, despite being suspended, despite being now slapped with a show cause penalty. But let's not beat up too much on Harbaugh, because I'm tempted to kind of look at this in the same way that I'm looking at the way the NCAA is kind of rolling back a lot of the penalties that they dished out for athletes who were transferring or accepting impermissible benefits. And I'm going, attitudes have changed. Is college athletics just professional sports now? And is there even a place for the NCAA? in this ecosystem, or is it just symbolic that there's an organizing body? Like, nothing they do has any kind of merit.
It just seems like the NCAA does this to, like, try to get a win. And, like try to embarrass Jim Harbaugh. It's like, dude, nobody cares.
It's a participation certificate on their wall. And Harbaugh's in the NFL. And it just doesn't, it has no teeth to it. I wish the NCAA had real leadership. If it did, I don't think the college sports would be in the predicament it's in. 5 at 5 is coming up. I cannot wait to see what Steven's going to introduce. I've got a lot to say about it. I hope you stick around. Charles Barkley talking about networks. We touched on this. He's going to stay with TNT. Plus, you'll hear a little from Ben Gulbranson, who I think is going to be the starter at Oregon State this season.
BFFT. From the Pack West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Can you imagine what college athletics would feel like if it truly acknowledged that it was professional sports? It is professional sports. It's just not willing to acknowledge it at this point. At some point, it will. And I kind of wonder how that will change the thinking and the mindset as it pertains to a lot of the topics we've been talking about. We're going to play the 5 at 5. Do we play the 5 at 5 or do we do the 5 at 5? Steven, you're going to queue up what you think are the 5 best stories. I am going to offer my 2 cents about each of them, and we're going to move quickly. Later this hour, I need your involvement as a listener. I want it. I want to check in with you as it pertains to the upcoming college football season. How tuned in are you? How excited are you? What are you excited about? What turns you off when it comes to what you're seeing? What makes you say, "Hey, I'm going to see more games than ever"? Are you going to see more games than ever? Are you going to show up at Research Stadium if you're an Oregon State fan? Are you going to show up at Autzen Stadium to see Big Ten teams if you're an Oregon fan? I haven't really taken the temperature with you, and I want your input later this hour. So stick around, Steven. Let's do this.
The 5 at 5. Number one.
Well, the NCAA has announced a 4-year show clause for former Michigan coach Jim Harbaugh today. For impermissible contact with recruits and players, will access was restricted during the COVID-19 pandemic. So this has nothing to do with the Connor Stallions investigation that they're still working on. This has to do with the recruiting violations back during the COVID era. NCAA had already put Michigan on 3 years probation, along with a fine, recruiting limits after reaching a negotiated resolution in that case. NCAA said Harbaugh engaged in unethical conduct, failed to promote an atmosphere of compliance, and violated head coaching responsibility obligations. So a lot of mumbo-jumbo to say, hey, Jim Harbaugh, you can't coach at college even though you're not coming back to the college game.
Yeah, he was technically out till August the 6th of 2028. I sort of flipped through the 48 pages that the NCAA wasted on this. It's a toothless penalty. He's in the NFL. He's got a deal with the Chargers that is going to keep him in the NFL. He's got no interest in coming back. He's got a 5-year deal with the Chargers and a 4-year show cause penalty in the NCAA. He's going to make an average salary of $16 million a year, not being punished by the NCAA.
I guess that recruiting worked out during the pandemic there.
It did. I wish that the NCAA, like, again, let's talk about whether it was a professional. If it was a professional league and had any kind of authority whatsoever, it would be able to slap Jim Harbaugh with a fine and exercise that fine. I mean, there's just no culpability here. He'll get $16 million a year to ignore the NCAA.
Number 2.
Well, Brandon Ayuk is a 49er for now, but apparently the 49ers are still interested in trading him. But one team that is apparently out is the New England Patriots. Ayuk, there was interest for Ayuk from the Patriots, the Browns, and the Steelers, but apparently Ayuk turned down the Patriots' extension offer. The Patriots had opted to no longer pursue a trade for Ayuk, according to ESPN. New England was prepared to make him the highest contract offer out of all the teams pursuing him, about over $30 million per year. But Ayuk said he did not want to go to the Patriots and should not show any interest in going to New England. So now with the Patriots out of the picture, everyone's turned into the Browns and the Steelers for the Ayuk sweepstakes, as the Browns have also received permission to negotiate a deal with Brandon Ayuk, but 49ers not traded him yet, but apparently Ayuk does not want to go to New England. Looks like Cleveland or Pittsburgh is one of the answers.
The interesting thing is Ayuk does not have a no-trade clause in his contract, but he has the equivalent of a no-trade clause because he can tell teams that potentially would try to trade for him, like the Patriots, that I will not sign with you. And so therefore the Patriots will go, eh, we're not going to trade for him. So Ayuk's got some say in this, and it complicates the matter for the 49ers because this isn't just about the Niners trying to trade Brandon Ayuk. They have to trade him somewhere he wants to go. Doesn't want to go to New England. We see that. There's a lot of problems with this. I said it a couple days ago. Remember when that video was out and Ayuk was hugging Kyle Shanahan and hugging John Lynch at practice? You know, he's not playing, but he walked over and kind of slapped backs and hugged them. And I said, that's a show that is designed to create some leverage. I believe that more than ever now. I mean, the Niners cannot be happy that Brandon Ayuk is exercising his right to sit in and not earn. But I kind of wonder if they'll accept 50 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar.
Out of those two teams, which team would you rather Ayuk go to, the Browns or the Steelers? Or what's a better fit for him as a
player?
For
him?
Yeah.
Probably the Browns. I just think there's a little more there in the way the Steelers play. Mike Tomlin's offense, the quarterbacks in Pittsburgh, I don't love them.
There are rumors with the Browns that they would actually trade back Amari Cooper in a trade back from the 49ers, where the Steelers are not willing to get rid of Pat Freiermuth, the tight end, or George Pickens in a deal for Ayuk. So I think as a 49er guy, you may want the Browns because you may actually get a piece back that is very helpful coming next season.
But normally, teams that make these kinds of deals, even Kansas City with Tyreek Hill and Buffalo making a move, they'll make them in front of the draft so that they get picks in return. They want players in camp. They want players on the roster. They want something in return for their asset. It's how the NFL works. Unlike the NBA, where you will see teams just give up on a player and kind of move in another direction, in the NFL, everybody's got the same amount of money. When you give up a player that you drafted, you developed, who held an important place on your roster, you have to get something in return for that player, or it really does set you back. Keep an eye on that.
Have the 49ers fumbled this whole situation?
I think they fumbled it with the timing in kind of being in denial about, I don't know if they thought they could re-sign him, but or if they thought there would be more value for him. I don't know which it is, but they misjudged one of those two things. What are we on, four now?
Three.
That's what I said.
Number three.
I'll just make sure you knew.
Yeah, I knew that.
Noah Lyles, we remember him. He won the 100 meters in a crazy race, winning by 0.005 seconds just by a nose. Now, he is actually better at the 200-meter dash, and he got second in the semifinal today, which was the first loss he's had in that distance in the last 3 years, but he still qualified for the final, which is at 11:30 a.m. tomorrow by my account. Just nine men, John, in Olympic history have achieved winning the 100 and 200-meter dashes in the same Olympics, both titles. It's only happened nine times. Lyles is trying to be the 10th man to do it, the first American to do it since Carl Lewis in 1984. So something to watch for tomorrow, see if Noah Lyles can make some Olympic history and win the 200-meter.
That 100 was so amazing, and it literally came down to a blink between not just gold and silver, but gold, silver, bronze, and hey, we don't know your name, as Jerry Seinfeld once said.
Number four.
Iva Arquette, he's the number one ranked player in college baseball transfer portal. He played at Washington last season. He has committed to the Oregon State Beavers to play baseball next year. He's at second baseman, hit 325, 12 homers, 36 RBI. Was also an All Pac-12 honors as a defensive player last season. You know, Arquette, really good baseball player, going to Oregon State. Oregon State, their sports have lost a lot of players, John, in the last couple of years because of the unknown of what conference they're playing in, but they get a baseball commitment from a Big Ten team in Washington. Does that mean anything going to the future, or is that just the baseball thing for Oregon State?
No, it's 100%, but I think you got to look even deeper than that. Look back at when the season ended, and you know a lot of people wondered, would there be attrition on the Oregon State roster as it pertained to baseball? Didn't happen. Players have hung in there. Players have said they're coming back. I am told that Oregon State's schedule for baseball, which has not been released, I can tell you this. They're going to play Oregon. They're going to play Washington. They're going to play the best schools in the WCC and the Big West. They're going to play a couple of the Big Ten schools, including Minnesota. Nebraska, I think, is on the schedule as well. They're putting together a really nice schedule, and the players trust that Oregon State is going to be a participant and have a puncher's chance to get to Omaha as they do every year. Adley Rutschman, Travis Bazana. The history in baseball predicts that Oregon State can survive as an independent. But credit to Oregon State for putting together the schedule that players believe in.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Does Oregon State baseball need a conference? Because the football teams, basketball teams, they need a conference. Does the baseball team need a conference, or can they go forward from a couple of years as an independent, or do they need to try to get into the Big 12, which does have some baseball powers as well?
They don't need it. They can play as an independent. They're an outlier. The question will become, because the scholarship limits in baseball are expanding, is there donor support at Oregon State as it pertains to baseball for donors to step up and fund those extra scholarships? I think they're jumping up to like 33 scholarships. Will the baseball donors at Oregon State say, yes, we're going to invest and we'll cover those scholarships? Because I think a lot of the programs, the non-revenue generating programs, are going to turn to boosters and ask that question. They're not going to have any trouble getting schedules, getting teams to play them. They are a quad one opponent. So they've got people lined up saying, we will play Oregon State because they help your schedule. If you're one of the best teams in the WCC, one of the best teams in the Big West, you go, hey, I want to play them. Now, I am told Stanford and Cal refused to play Oregon State. Stanford and Cal said, we're going on the road in all these ACC games. We're not coming up to the Pacific Northwest to play you. But credit to Mark Wasikowski, the Oregon baseball coach. Credit to Washington's baseball program. They're playing the Beavers. They will play them in non-conference matchups. I am told this. I don't have the full schedule, but I got a peek at some of the opponents. There's at least two other Big Ten opponents that are on it. I think it's Minnesota and Nebraska, or Minnesota and Iowa, or Nebraska. It's those two or three schools were involved. I think Scott Barnes, the AD at Oregon State, who had promised that he would put the schedule together, has delivered on that front.
Number five.
Well, we talked about this, I believe, last week with Anna about the proposal by the badminton fan. Well, he was a player, and then his fiance won the gold medal. He then went on the court and proposed right after the gold medal winning. Now, we got a different one going on here. French Olympian Alice Finot, she plays fourth in her race in the steeplechase, but set a European record with her time. But it was after the race where Finot proposed to her boyfriend in the crowd. So she races, and then she makes a proposal to him. Her boyfriend, Bruno Martinez Barigala, he was emotional the entire time, and then he said yes to Finot. So there was a chance, though, that Finot said she was not going to go through with the proposal. She told a local outlet, if she finished above 9 minutes, that she would not have proposed to her boyfriend. But she broke it. She got it. She got under by just about 2 seconds. But then she goes and proposes. Now, we had a problem with the badminton guy.
I still have a problem with the badminton guy.
I do, too. But I don't have a problem with this one because it was her race.
It's different.
It was her race.
It's different.
She went and did it. And I like the fact that she proposed to him on her stage. It was her stage, and she did it. No problem with this one. Still a problem with the badminton one.
I am old-fashioned, so I did kind of bristle a little bit, and people are going to get mad at me, but I didn't like the image of her getting down on a knee with him. I was like, he should still be on his knee while she's proposing to him. But anyway, I digress. It's different when it's her moment. The badminton situation was this, for people who don't know. The significant other was a spectator. And the person who got proposed to just won a gold medal. The guy was stealing the thunder and stealing the moment of his soon-to-be fiance by roping her into a proposal in front of the whole world. Now, there's a pressure element to both of these things. I don't know that I would advocate for people, my friends or my family members, to put people on the spot and, you know, have it be a big deal that somebody's put on the spot and pressure them into an answer in that moment. But I don't have an issue with the competitor proposing to a spectator.
Do you have a problem with proposals in sports in general?
Just don't think that should be a big public thing.
Like, for the athletes,
it's your
though.
Moment.
What about for the athletes? I understand, like, the fans, like, it's a little different, but, like, I don't necessarily like just proposals in general from the athletes. Like, just finish it up and do it.
I don't need to be at your proposal.
That's what I think.
If that's what you're asking.
Yeah.
I don't need to be part of it. And I don't think the strangers who came to the game sent, you know, or to the event went, oh, I'm going to watch a race today. Somebody's going to pole vault or somebody's going to play badminton and, oh, maybe I'll see a proposal. Like, that's not part of the entertainment.
Like, they're not going home saying, oh, man, that was such a great proposal. No, it was such a great steeplechase.
Not going to believe what happened at this moment. But I'm adamant, and I had a lot of listeners who were listening to that segment where I went in, and Anna and I totally disagree on this. She says it's fine for the spectator to propose for the gold medalist. I said, nonsense. That guy's stealing his fiance's moment. And guess what? She better get used to it, because if he's doing it right now, he's going to continue to do this throughout their marriage. He's just going to steal every moment she has. She wins a game of Parcheesi, he's going to be right there to one-up her. You know, she cooks a meal, he's going to be right there to lead the toast. It's just, you can't be that guy and steal the moment. It was her moment. Let her enjoy it. Go propose afterwards. But in this case, the athlete saying, I'm having a great moment. I'm sucked up into the euphoria. Oh, by the way, let me pull out a ring and propose. I don't have an issue with the athlete doing it because it's their moment already. But
just that, that it was the woman to the man.
Yeah. Even that, I got over it pretty quickly. But it's just it was a little unorthodox, you know.
Yeah.
There's an element there too when someone's proposing that you go, can they really say no? Can they?
Well, in public you can't.
In public, and I don't know. I could be talked out of this. I want to hear your proposal story, if it involves sports at all. I remember years ago we launched a quest to find the greatest female sports fan that was listening to the show. And Sherry, who is a Blazer fan, Sherry, called in and said, you know, she was not only proposed to at a Blazer game, she got married in a Blazer-themed marriage ceremony. And I think even, like, Brian Wheeler and Bill Shonley were somehow in the mascot were involved in this thing. I want to hear from you. You know, you've been to sporting events where you've seen people propose. Is it appropriate, inappropriate? Have you launched a proposal at a sporting event? Help us understand why. Or were you proposed to at a sporting event? Was there a sports theme at your wedding? I want to hear from you. Fill us in. Educate us. Help us understand it. Maybe you'll change some minds. Maybe you won't. 503-417-7575.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Longtime listeners of the show may remember years ago we did a big contest to find the biggest diehard sports fan listener who happened to be female who was listening to this show. I don't think we could do that contest today. I think we would get criticism from people who said, well, just do the biggest sports fan. Why does it have to be about a man or a woman? But it was at a time when it was like, all right, let's find our biggest diehard fan. And we had a big contest. And we got down to in studio a few contestants who had advanced to the finals over several weeks. I think there was even prizes involved. And we got down to Blazer fan Sherry, who, you know, was basically saying that she had gone all the way as it pertained to her sports fandom. And I'm going to play this. She happens to be talking about a baby shower here. I don't know what this clip is about, but I know that she was showing what a fan she is. Are you ready to do this?
I'm hyped. Let's go.
Do you get, first of all, have you got a lot of feedback from people as you're out and about? People know who you are.
Yeah, they do. And yes, I have gotten a lot of feedback. It took you guys long enough to bring us back for the second round.
We like to make you wait.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. I hosted a baby shower on Sunday, and probably 3/4 of the women there at the baby shower were like, when's the next round? When's the next round? And then I get a email from Noah at 9:15 at night. I wish I would have got that earlier.
You should bring him to the baby shower. He is a riot at baby showers. He does awesome. I've heard this.
I do. I do dog and pony tricks. You know? No, I don't.
I was waiting for more. Yeah. Like, whoa, where's this going? Really?
So Blazer fan Sherry had her friends at the baby shower all fired up about the fact that she was, you know, qualified for the final round of this contest. I think she won the thing, and I think part of it was she had a tattoo of her team. She had been proposed to at a game. She had been married in a Blazer-themed wedding. And it was kind of like she was checking some boxes of doing some things some other fans wouldn't do. You know what I mean? So I want to hear from you. How do you feel in general about sporting event proposals? We've seen a couple here involving the Olympics, one involving a badminton player who won a gold medal and her boyfriend proposed to her on the spot. The second one now involving a track athlete who had a terrific performance and then ran to the stands, pulled out a ring, and proposed to her boyfriend. She got down on a knee. How do you feel about being involved in that as a sports fan? For me, I'm kind of the mindset of, like, leave that between you guys. I guess I can watch it if I want to, but I've never been that interested in it, and I wonder why people rope the rest of us into it. Have you ever been proposed to at a sporting event? Have you done a proposal? Have you been nearby one? Now, you'll see the game operations people in NBA arenas who will do bits based on this concept where they'll have somebody propose and somebody turns them down, and it becomes kind of a bad scene, and popcorn gets thrown or whatever, and it becomes kind of a funny thing. But I have often kind of wondered about the person getting put on the spot in front of 18 or 19,000 other fans and the pressure that brings. And do they really get married? Do they just say it because people are watching and they don't want that public pressure and that accountability? I've also seen one proposal where the guy had it put up on the Jumbotron screen or whatever we call that thing now, and the girl didn't notice that she was being proposed to. She just thought she was on the Jumbotron. So she didn't read the words. And so she was kind of acting like a fan, waving her arms and dancing around. And then suddenly he was like, hey, no, read the words. And then she was like, oh, my gosh, I'm getting proposed to. 503-417-7575. You tell me. Steven, where do you stand on this?
I think for me, I don't want to see the athletes do it. I think I want them to do it in their own time. Like, let's just celebrate your accomplishments on the field, on the court, on the track, whatever it is. I get that this is your moment and you're having a great time, but I would like to have that be their own special moment. I think for fans, I don't like it, but I understand it because for when they're going to their team's game, like, that is the most important thing until now they're getting married, where hopefully that's the most important thing. And it kind of is, it's kind of one of those things where you are filling in the gap there. Like, you are changing your favorite thing from being your sports team to your husband or wife. So I kind of feel like that's okay. I think it's fun to put on the big Jumbotron there and watch it. It's cute. It's nice. You got to have something for, you know, the halftime entertainment or in between quarters, whatever it is. I actually don't have a problem with it. I would never do it. I would never propose to anybody that way. That's just not me, but I think it's kind of entertaining from a fan's perspective to watch other fans do it. But the players, I just don't want to see the players
Wouldn't it be more entertaining if they gave an honest answer or we knew something about the couple that was, you know, we don't have a bio. We don't know their relationship history. We don't know if they're a little crazy. You know, we don't know what's going on in that relationship.
I like that part because I just make it up myself. You're just judging every single person. Like, oh man, that person's crazy.
Let's go to Craig, who has called in. Craig, help us out here. Where do you stand on this?
John, in terms of public, not necessarily sports related, but public wedding proposals, I was cautioned not to do it. But I did it anyway at the Portland City Grill. And 10 years later, I got fleeced for about $900,000. So I would caution everyone, no public wedding proposals.
But isn't the issue that the downfall of the marriage and not the proposal in your case?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, accurate.
I think it's bad juju, and so okay. I'm witness to that. Okay. What I really called about, John, is just a real quick thing. You talking earlier about college football. I don't mean to change the direction of the show.
But you're
talking about Dan Lanning, and I really like Dan Lanning as a person, and I think he's a great fit for Oregon. But let's not, you know, so many people out there are just wetting their pants over this guy right now. And let's remember that the two critical losses that Oregon faced in those Husky games fell squarely on his shoulders. And not on the players. The players won the game, but the coaches lost the game. And maybe I'm sensitive to this subject because I had a kid that played. And when the kids play their butts off and play to win the game and the coaches lose the game, you know, it's just so bad. I need to see Dan Lanning, you know, not only be a great recruiter, but I need to see him be a great game day coach and not make dumb mistakes before I'll really believe in this guy.
I kind of think you're talking about the same thing. If I can sew those two thoughts together, you talking about the bad juju born of proposing in a public setting and also, getting to know your coach more before you, you know, aren't you really saying get to know your coach, get to know your fiance better before you marry him? And there's a lot of people eager to marry Dan Lanning as their all-time favorite Duck coach in the same way that I heard people eager to marry Mario Cristobal. And let's face it, if we're being real, Willie Taggart. And let's face it, if we're being real, Mark Helfrich. I heard Duck fans who, after those coaches had some success, went all in. Mark Helfrich took the Ducks to a national title game. Rob Mullins married him after the title game, gave him a big contract extension that he later regretted, and caused a eight-figure buyout with Mark Helfrich to have to happen. And so I think what Craig is saying is, you know, do your diligence, get to know that significant other or significant coach before you marry him. There's a natural inclination from fans when they see a coach have some success who's their coach to hitch their wagon to it. And I get it. I don't blame him for that. But with Dan Lanning, I do feel something different there. I do feel like he's on point with his messaging and his branding about substance. He's had enough success, 22-5 in two seasons. I get what Craig's saying. The five losses, you look at him, three of them are to Washington. That's a problem, or that raises an eyebrow. You know, do you need to do a background check before, you know, you need to see more, right? Like, you need to talk to some people before you need his bigger sample size. You need to see him win this year, a year that he should win that game going away. So I get it. And I think Craig is raising a good point there. 503-417-7575. That opens a line. I want to hear from you. Did you propose at a game or a sporting event? Did you do a public proposal in general? Or did you get proposed to in public? I would love to hear somebody who either did a public proposal or got proposed to tell us that it was okay, there was no additional public pressure, or this is how it felt to have all these people looking at me while someone else is down on a knee, or I was down on a knee and everybody was looking, like, you know, because when I proposed, it was a very private setting. We were, like, there was almost nobody there. It was intentional by me. I didn't want to share that moment with anybody. I was just kind of trying to have a private moment, and, you know, I don't relate to somebody who wants that to be a public thing. But I'll go further with it. You know, recently, Anna and I celebrated an anniversary. And I found it interesting that we both posted publicly on social media about the anniversary. Now, I had a thought that day, and I waited until the afternoon to post because I was thinking, like,
Is that something that I should be doing publicly? Where do you stand on that, Stephen? People who wish each other happy birthday, happy anniversary, you know, you're the love of my life, on social media. Basically, you're telling everybody else what you should be telling your spouse in private. But I'll be honest with you, you know, we all know that that post is probably more important to one of the people in the relationship than the other.
Yeah, no,
if you catch my drift.
I agree with you, because, yeah, you should be telling them that anyways, and you should be telling them that every single day. Like, that's the thing. But I think it's – it's not that I don't like it. I don't mind doing it. Like, there was a stretch where I think my last two Instagram posts were both, like, posts to my wife. Like, that's all I had posted. And I think it's fine. I think people do enjoy it. For me, like, I don't really like seeing those posts. Like, I don't, you know, I'll like it. Maybe I won't. And I'll just scroll right by it. It doesn't do much for me, because usually if I'm going to say happy birthday or I'm going to say whatever, I'm going to probably text you or see you in person and say it to you. I don't need to have, you know, the whole internet seeing that I said it to you. Like, it's not a big deal to me. But, I mean, I understand, like, why you do it. It's just kind of what you do. But, I mean, if I had to choose, I would rather not do them than do them. But they're pretty easy to make nowadays, so it's not that bad.
And I have also learned, like, there was a Valentine's Day a few years ago where, you know, Anna and I said, oh, we're not going to do what everybody else does. We're not doing this schmoopy Valentine's thing. We're not going to exchange cards. There's not going to be any flowers, you know. This was several years ago. And, of course, she went off to work. She was working at K2 in the newsroom, and of course everybody in the newsroom was getting flowers and getting a card, or the guys were talking about their dinner plans and all this stuff. And she came home and she was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I was like, okay, lesson learned. So I can remember having a conversation with Mario Cristobal one evening on a Valentine's Day. I was parking the car and we were going to dinner. And we were in downtown Portland, and I was parking the car. I had dropped Anna off at the restaurant. I was kind of circling around looking for a parking spot, as sometimes happens. And Mario Cristobal called me, and he's like, I'm on my way home from the football facility. I did not buy a Valentine's Day card or a present. What do I do? That was Mario Cristobal calling me. I was like, what you don't do is call me for that answer. You know,
it
happens
to all of us. That's what it is. It happens to all of us.
I don't know your relationship. You know, and I said, you better, you know, I said, don't go buy her like a set of sheets or something right now. You know, go get her a card and write something in there that is meaningful between the two of you. And by the way, I'm not ghostwriting this thing. You know,
that's what he was hitting. He wanted you to, you know,
I think he was.
Get some nice words out there.
I think he probably was asking me to ghostwrite it. And I was like, I'm good. But
like, it doesn't have to be a big grand gesture. That's my, you know, it doesn't have to be a grand gesture. It's just a little thing that you can do. And they make it so easy now to make a little collage that you can put pictures on to be like, oh, you know, you were my, you know, you're my bud. You're my best friend. And I'm glad I married you. That's all you got to put.
We had a engineer one time. I was on a remote broadcast and it was his girlfriend's birthday. And he was saying he was on, you know, he kind of was new to the job. He had moved. He had a bunch of moving expenses. And he was like, I don't have a lot of money to take her to dinner or buy her something expensive. And I brought up the sheets that I said, don't buy her a pair of sheets or set of sheets, because this engineer had done that. He had gone out to like Macy's or Nordstrom and he had bought like a nice set of sheets for the, you know, the bed. And I was like, that's not a birthday present that says I know you, unless like you're married to or dating Martha Stewart. Like, this is a bad idea, dude. And I was like, this is a horrible idea. It became more important than the radio show. And I told him, I said, you need to take the sheets back. You're not giving her sheets on her birthday. Go take them back. I said, go down to like Paper Source or stationery store, get a like a small journal. And go print out a bunch of photos of you guys dating, and you better start writing about your favorite memories and sticking those photos in the journal. Do something sentimental. When in doubt, go sentimental. You don't go sheets. And he literally got sheets. And I told Anna that, and she just slapped her forehead. She's like, he cannot gift her those sheets. And so we saved him. We probably saved his relationship that day. I don't know if we should have. I felt like you know, it's kind of one of those things, like if you have a time machine, do you go back in time? And do you, you know, for example, like, you know, Stephen, if you had a time machine and you could time travel, you might go to some point in history and try to change the course of history, you know, and or you might memorize every World Series winner since 1909, and then just whatever year you drop in on, you would know what to bet. That's probably what you would do. Mm-hmm. But I always say, like, people go, oh, you know, you don't want to change history because then you'd have all this butterfly effect that you would change all these things. And so I wonder if we had a butterfly effect by keeping that relationship together. Maybe I just should have let him gift the sheets. She would have broken up with him, like, at the earliest convenience, like, you know, 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, after the next holiday or whatever his, you know, his grandmother, if his grandmother was really sick, she would have waited till, you know, Nana died, and then she would have broke up with him afterwards. And then maybe she was supposed to be with someone else. Maybe he was supposed to be with someone else. Maybe I shouldn't be meddling in all of this.
Well, you probably saved someone else's relationship too. Like, someone else,
I don't know,
heard that and was like, oh, you don't buy him a dishwasher for their birthday?
No, you don't. Don't go with a practical gift that says I don't know you. Don't go with a gift card either. You can't do that with a gift card for somebody that you care about. You have to go sentimental. When in doubt, lean on your memories. Look at your phone. Pick out the favorite photos you have. Send them to Walgreens. Print them out. Stick them in a journal and write about, oh, I remember that time we went on the carousel. Remember that time we got stuck in the airport in Chicago. Remember, you know, whatever it is in your life. But, you know, I don't need to be your relationship advice person. That's the bigger point. Leave it here. Some parting thoughts coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Yesterday at the end of the show, we did a underrated or overrated or maybe accurately rated segment where we talked about the college football teams ranked by the coaches poll in the top 25. I would like to continue some of that here with Stephen and I bantering about it. If you'd like to participate and you hear something that you have an opinion on or you think I have it dead wrong, I'd love to hear from you at 503-417-7575. But let's start right here with the underrated, overrated, or accurately rated segment of radio. Stephen Vaughn, Damian Lillard, overrated, underrated, accurately rated?
Overrated.
Do you
want to be reason why or just...
Yeah, go ahead.
Defensively, really bad, always has been. I think he's a really hard player to play with. Now, he can score a bunch, but I think if you're playing with him, it's very tough. He gets credited for all the points he scores, but what that does is it kind of ices you out as another player, and then you're expected to just perform at your top level every single play when he decides he wants to pass you the ball. But having said that, Hall of Fame player, top 75 of all time, for sure. Just, if he's your best player, you're probably not winning an NBA championship, and I think people view him as that.
I'm going to say overrated as well, but only because I watched Blazers fans lose their minds over what was really nice personal success for him, but modest success for the franchise. In a lot of ways, like in the same way I think Bacon, like everybody talks about Bacon. Oh, Bacon's the greatest thing ever. Bacon's so great. Fan bases do that with their star players. Bacon's overrated, okay? It is. It's a little bit overrated. It is. I grew up, I raised pigs as a kid. I was around Bacon quite a bit. Bacon's good. Don't get me wrong. You got a nice, you know, slice of crispy bacon laid out for me in the morning. I'm probably going to take it. But I don't think, like, Bacon is the greatest thing ever. In the same way that I look at a player like Damian Lillard and I go, hey, really awesome that he made, like, all NBA teams and that he scored a lot of points, got a lot of opportunities. But like you, Stephen, I saw the Blazers as a team kind of just hit a ceiling where they didn't get beyond this, like, winning a game in the second round of the playoffs with him. Never seemed as interested in the team being better as he did his own personal stats. Just keeping it real.
Bacon Hall of Fame food, but not, you know, not one of the greatest of all time.
Bacon's really good. Damian Lillard's really good. So, just saying, let's not get out of hand. All right, underrated or overrated brunch as a meal?
I'm going to go... That's a good one. I'm going to go overrated. I think it's fine. I don't like that I have to wait a little bit longer, so it's in the middle, so it's a breakfast-lunch type of combo. I also think that if we're just going to go good breakfast, just go good breakfast. We're going to go good lunch, so go good lunch. I don't need the combination of it. It makes too many decisions on myself, and then I get overstuffed on it. So I'm going to go overrated. Like, I like it, but I would prefer just like, hey, let's go out for breakfast or let's go for lunch. Not let's both.
I'm not like a big let's wake up early in the morning and have a big breakfast guy. Like, you know, I see people eating omelets, and I've had omelets, but I'm going to say that brunch is underrated because it falls in that space where I'm usually getting a hankering. That's about the time of morning where my blood sugar's dropping. It's not lunch. It's after breakfast. I've had my coffee. That is when I am most interested in having that omelet. So I'm going to say brunch is underrated. Underrated or overrated, Dak Prescott as a quarterback?
I'm going to go underrated on this one. I don't think Dak's great, but I think there's so much pressure on him in Dallas to win ball games every single season, and he does that for the most part. They didn't lose that Packer playoff game because Dak was terrible. They lost because the defense gave up like 40 points, and they haven't had the best running game the last couple of seasons. We saw when Ezekiel Elliott was young, and Dak was young as well. Like, they were great because they had a great run game, great offensive line. I think that's how most quarterbacks are. You're not Patrick Mahomes. So I think Dak is good enough to win a Super Bowl. Now, he's going to be overrated as soon as he gets $60 million. But as of right now, John, I think he's underrated.
He had, I thought, a pretty good 2023 season. They lost to Green Bay. It was a disaster to lose to Green Bay. But his passing grade, his passing rating... the way he protected the ball, he did not turn the ball over. In fact, I was looking at Pro Football Focus. He had 37 throws that came in pressure situations, high pressure situations in 2023, as defined by Pro Football Focus. The most in the NFL, 37 big time throws, they called it. He had, among those throws, a 2% turnover play rate. It was the lowest among quarterbacks who had 400 attempts or 400 pass plays in the league. He was very efficient. He took care of the ball. I'm going to agree with you that Dak Prescott, underrated.
But once he gets his $60 million, is your vote changing?
Then he becomes overpaid. New York Yankees, underrated, overrated. Jake Dicker brought him up earlier. He held up the Yankees as an example of that's one way to build a roster. Underrated, overrated?
I'm going to go with properly rated. Okay. Like, they are elite. They always are. And, well, ever since George Steinbrenner really, buckled down on it, they have been elite, and they've been really good, and they've been in contention for the most part. Like, with Derek Jeter, I know he's a little overrated, people think, but in his final game, he got the game-winning hit in Yankee Stadium. That was the first RBI he had at Yankee Stadium, where his team wasn't in the playoff race. Like, they were officially out of the playoffs. That was the first time ever he had that. So they're always in the playoff race, and I think in baseball, you just got to give yourself a chance to be in it at the end of the season. And the Yankees do that every single year, so I'm going to say properly rated.
Do they, though? Last year, they didn't do it. And, 2 years ago, they lost in the ALCS.
But they're in the playoffs.
3 years ago,
they're
in the wild card. 4 years ago, they lost in the division series. I'm going back 15 years before I see. It's been 15 years since they won the World Series.
But it's playoff.
Hideki Matsui was the World Series MVP the year last time the Yankees won it. I think Jake Dickert, he held up the Yankees because it's like saying U.S. Steel, right? They're a brand. It's the Dallas Cowboys. I think they're not on the level of the Dallas Cowboys, where the Cowboys have just had so much slippage with Jerry Jones calling the shots, but they're spending like crazy, and they're getting decent results. I say overrated. You say accurately rated. But I don't know. 2009 was their last World Series.
But also, if the Yankees are in the playoff race and they're going for it, it's more entertaining.
Yes, I would agree with that. Underrated or overrated? Georgia football?
Underrated. I think we forget about
really?
Them. Yes. I think we've, as a, I don't know about, you know, I think nationally probably is a little bit different. But they are, I think you said this yesterday, like they're by far the best team in the nation. I don't know that I'd go that far, but I think right now, like they're undisputed number one, and that's where they should be, and that's where they should have been the last couple of years. They should have made the playoff last year. They were a top four team. They just decided to lose one game at the end of the season. That's their first loss in two seasons. I think that they are consistently at the top, and they will be for a while, and we're kind of overlooking them. We want to, you know, we want to crown these other teams and say, oh, Ohio State's going to do it. Oregon's going to be that team. Well, last time Oregon played Georgia, it was a 49-3 win. I know it's a couple of years ago, and it's going to be different now, but Georgia has that team and has been that team for the last 5 years. I think we're just kind of sleeping on them a little bit still this year. Like, they're the favorite, and they should be the favorite.
I hear you saying that they're underrated because they've won 47 of the last 49 football games they've played in, and that people kind of just take that for granted. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Like, or people
yes.
just kind of don't give them the credit that they get.
Yeah, they're old news. Like, we've seen that before. We want to crown the new shiny thing when that the best thing's already there. We've seen it, and it's right in front of our faces.
I'll buy that, but I wanted to say they were appropriately rated because they're rated number one, and I have a hard time saying that a team that's picked number one by the coaches poll could be underrated, but I'll buy your underrated thing. Underrated or overrated? Grilled cheese sandwich, rapid fire here.
Overrated.
Paper bags at a grocery store.
Overrated.
Movie theater popcorn butter.
Oh, way overrated.
I agree with that one. I appreciate everybody who listens to the show. The podcast of the show is highly underrated. Make sure you subscribe on Apple if you want to get it. Also, I appreciate everybody who listens to the show and reads me at johncanzano.com.